Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to What Clinicians Want to Know, First Line and Maintenance Therapy for Patients with Extensive Stage Small Cell Cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Luis Paz-Ares, who's from the head of the Lung Cancer Unit at the National Oncology, the University area, 12th of October, the Research Center in Madrid, Spain, and Dr. Misty Shields, from the Indiana University Melvin and Bren Simon Comprehensive Cancer Center in Indianapolis, Indiana. Today, it looks like a narrow topic, but we're going to have a tough time getting through in an hour. There's a lot of things to talk about in terms of extensive stage small cell. As is always the case, it seems, we will be discussing the use of non-FDA-approved agents and regimens, so check out prescribing information for specific products and information. So all of our programs over the years have always been oriented around asking investigators questions, particularly how they take care of patients. Our primary target audience is the community-based general medical oncologist. So for this webinar tonight, we actually did a survey over the last couple of weeks of 50 general medical oncologists, and we got hundreds of questions. We told them what we're going to talk about here. And I sifted through them and picked out like the top 40 or something. We'll see how many of these we can get through, but really great questions. Here's where we're heading. We're going to start out first chatting a little bit about what I call the question of the tail of the curve. And then we'll get into first-line chemoimmunotherapy, where we were, I think, until ASCO. Then we'll talk about maintenance lurbinectinib. Of course, so much to talk about there. And then even more when we get to second-line therapy and tarlatamab, where that's heading. Then we'll get into ongoing research, particularly ADCs. So just before we get started, I want to kind of reflect back on a program we did. Maybe some of you were watching. We broadcast it live. We were in Dallas for the American Oncology Network annual meeting that we always go to with Dr. Divers and his group. And I actually met with five of the AON docs ahead of time. We produced a bunch of case videos and presented them. But as I sat there watching the program, and Misty was actually on the lung panel there, over the 5 hours that we did the program, there was one slide that came up there that really caught my attention with a lot of relevance to what we're talking about today, and that was in the lung section. So we had Dr. Gaynor from MGH. We had Corey Langer from Penn. Misty from Indiana and Fred was moderating it. And what really caught my attention and got me to think a lot about, well, before I get into this, I guess I should also say that at the same time they were up there, Misty, your Indiana Hoosiers were winning an exciting football game in the last second. And I just want to ask you, now that Ohio State is number one and you guys are number two, I know your colleague in breast cancer, Kathy Miller, is like an ardent Ohio State fan. So I want to know whether you and Kathy are fighting over who's going to win the championship game.
I think so. I think that we might be going head-to-head, so stay tuned. I think there's going to be more here, but hopefully IU wins it out.
Well, anyhow, congratulations on that thrilling win. And actually, Luis, the slide that I caught my attention, I just found out in talking to you, was actually a slide you made that you loaned to Corey, and Corey showed it. So here's the slide. Like I said, sometimes I never know, am I the last person to see something or not? But when I saw this slide and I heard Corey talk about it, I was like, wow, I don't know if I was really aware of that. I think this is important. And Luis, maybe you can just talk a little bit about the fact that it looks like, and according to Corey, there's a tail on the curve of these chemoimmunotherapy studies. Obviously, the two big ones with approvals, Atezo and Durva. There was also, of course, a phase 3 Pembro. It didn't end up getting approved. But what he pointed out, and we're going to go through some of the data behind this, because to me, this is a very, very important finding. I'm not sure everybody's aware of. I was not. Is that it looks like maybe 10% or so of people with extensive stage small cell are hitting the five-year point and may be cured. And to me, Luis, this is a different story, a different way to talk to patients. I mean, 1 out of 10, it'd be great if it was 8 out of 10, but 1 out of 10 is different. And incidentally, just for all you AI people, when we asked ChatGPT what the five-year survival was of extensive stage small cell, it says less than 2%. So don't necessarily trust your AI. And even Open Evidence says it's 5%. And now you guys are saying it's maybe 10%, maybe even more. So do you want to comment a little bit on this, Luis? And also, do you bring this up to patients? If patients say, is there a chance I'd be cured? Like, how do you answer that question?
Yeah, I mean, you're totally right. I mean, when we first saw the result of these trials with immunotherapy in addition to chemo in first-line extensive stage small cell lung cancer, we realized that there was some benefit, but the benefit was not overwhelming, the magnitude of the benefit. The good thing now that we have mature data with extensive follow-up, we know that those patients that are benefiting, many of them are benefiting in the long run. And as you said, we have a survivorship at 5 years in the range of 10 to 15%, which is really great news. And, you know, I always recall a Cochrane review in 2000, survival at 2 years, not five, at 2 years in extensive stage was 6.7% in extensive stage and was about 20% in early stage, in limited stage. So this is great news. And actually, we have to talk about that with patients. Some patients would say, you know, I'm not going to go through chemo. I'm going to somehow maybe respond for a while, but relapse very early. But this is a third dimension that we didn't talk about some years ago. We know now that some patients are really long-term survivors, and I think this is very good news.
And Misty, you know, we're going to talk, of course, about the big news of the summer and one of the big stories of the summer at ASCO, the IMforte study and the use of lurbinectinib as maintenance and whether it's worth the additional toxicity. But to me, you know, if you're talking about the potentially curative goal, you know, you see this is different than maintenance therapy, where, you know, palliative care where you want to minimize toxicity. If you have a younger patient with a family, et cetera, or an older patient, very motivated, not that oriented around toxicity. The fact that you as an oncologist are actually aiming for cure, to me, maybe changes the conversation a little bit. And I'm curious how this comes up when you talk to patients, Misty.
So, you know, absolutely. I think for our patients and their families, you know, every day matters. And I think that to see an extension study with 12%, really 11% at 6 years, I mean, outstanding. We're seeing really a 5x of the tail of the curve, you know, there with the lifting from 2% or 1%. And it's so meaningful, you know, that this is very real. We should counsel our patients and be very open and honest to say we're going to keep a close eye, but it may be that this regimen helps put you in remission and hopefully for long-term cure. And I am transparent with my patients that, you know, you can see the curve is quite steep, but then there is this clear tail with all anti-PD-1 and PD-L1 therapies that have been studied. And so, you know, we don't have a biomarker. Carl Gaze looked at the role of transcriptomics with the inflamed subtype. We know PD-L1, TMB don't predict in small cell like they do with non-small cell or other cancer types. But I think really it is meaningful. There are patients, I have them in my own clinic, and it's, you know, these needles in the haystack are there. We just have to find them.
So I'm just going to flip through a bunch of slides from this data that we're really referring to. We're not going to spend any time really going through that. I just want you to know that a lot of the data that we're talking about, particularly from the Empower study, looking at atezolizumab, is where we really get the five-year data. The other studies, and here's, we look at PD-1, doesn't look like it's that correlated. There's real-world data that's looked at this issue as well, the I Am Real Cohort 4 study you can check out, and from the Caspian study, which, of course, had durvalumab, also with or without tremelimumab, although we know durvalumab ended up with, you know, being really what we ended up using there. But again, you see these long-term survivals. Luis, in a way, it kind of reminds me a little bit of what you see in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, where, you know, you see maybe a 50% cure rate with upfront therapy. Then another therapy, and here's the Luminance study looking more at durvalumab. But in diffuse large B-cell, we had another study that came out now adding an ADC, polatuzumab, to upfront therapy. They saw, you know, better outcomes, and everybody started using that. But again, in the context of trying to improve the cure rate. So I just want to bring this up in, by way of introduction, because I think it really colors the way you look at the data and you look at talking to patients. Just going to summarize, we spent actually very little time talking about small cell on Saturday, so it's great to have the opportunity to talk so much more about it. It is one of the most exciting areas, I think, in oncology. But here are Corey's conclusions. We're really going to focus. We're going to talk a lot about all these things, including limited stage, where we also see an improvement in long-term survival with IOs. Obviously, we'll talk about lurbinectomin with atezo as maintenance. And, of course, we'll talk about tarlatamab, the big presentation at ASCO in the second-line setting, and then ADCs, particularly so-called IDXD. But I want to kind of spend a few minutes now letting the oncologists in practice throw a bunch of questions at you. So here we go. We'll see how many of these we can get through. So let me start out with you, Luis. You can tackle the first few. This question's been out there for a while, but we still get people asking it. Atezo versus Durva, any difference in efficacy? Now, of course, we have the issue of what about if you want to use atezo lurbinectinib? Cisplatin versus carbo, does that matter, Luis? What do you do with patients who are platinum ineligible? And when do you see, tumor lysis syndrome wasn't exactly on my radar either. So maybe you can comment a little bit about when you see that with small cell, Luis, and we can start out with the atezo versus Durva question. Mm.
Okay, so, you know, atezo and Durva are both PD-L1 inhibitors. Honestly, I don't have any data suggesting that they are different. They were a bit different, the trials. So, you know, the Caspian trial included some patients that had brain metastasis previously irradiated. That was not the case for Empower. The Empower allowed patients to receive a PCI. That was not the case here. So there were subtle differences. But today, to me, honestly, there is no big difference in the efficacy. The long-term data seems also very similar, and the overall results of the trial are similar. So to me, no big difference. The same is actually true for carboplatin and cisplatin. We have quite a good meta-analysis on that, and today I typically use carboplatin. It's much better tolerated, particularly, you know, extensively staged patients. I don't want my patients to receive cisplatin, which is inducing a lot more nausea, vomiting, and even renal failure and so on. So I do not typically treat with cisplatin these days, extensive stage. For platinum eligible, to be honest, very few patients are non-eligible to carboplatin. If any patient is not for that, I typically use a combination of adriamycin, vincristine, or etoposide plus cyclophosphamide. That is typically what I'm using. But honestly, that happened maybe once or twice a year.
Tumor lysis syndrome.
Oh, yeah. Oh, tumor lysis. Okay. This is something I'm taking very carefully. You know, very often our patients, when they are diagnosed, they really have huge tumors. The tumor volume is huge, and we know these tumors are responding very fast. So I tend to have this patient hydrated, well hydrated, with good diuresis. I tend to use bicarbonate to have an alkaline urine so that they are not getting precipitation. And I'm actually checking all of that and putting my patient allopurinol as well. And, you know, if you do that, that typically is not a big issue. But it's important to be careful about that. We had some cases in the past, so I'm pretty sure that everyone is taking care of it.
So any comment on that, Misty? And also, do you see tumor lysis more with chemo immunotherapy than, say, lurbinectinib or tarlatamab?
Yeah. So, you know, there's spontaneous tumor lysis. There's treatment-related tumor lysis. There's definitely case reports and case series of it with small cell lung cancer. We recently published a report of a case series with tarlatamab with tumor lysis syndrome, which makes sense. It is, you know, bispecific T-cell engager and induces tumor lysis. And so I think that there are potential risk factors, especially what we reported was, you know, potentially platinum-resistant, high hepatic tumor burden and, you know, potentially high LDH or other variables as well may cue you in that this tumor lysis may be occurring or may be prone to occur.
So I want to go back to you, Misty, a quick follow-up about trilaciclib, because I saw that you actually did a paper on that. And it's interesting because, you know, I was surprised that I saw questions about it. I wasn't sure whether people are using it. Your work suggested it's pretty effective from what I could see. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this was, you know, FDA approved by in February 2021 here in the U.S. And, you know, it's to be given days 1, 2, and 3 as a pre-medication before your chemo and or chemo and immunotherapy. It's very well tolerated. Really, the biggest side effect is thrombophlebitis, which is due to the sodium chloride resuspension with the drug. And so D5 can help mitigate that and reduce it or using it through a port. But yes, we see that it helps multi lineage protection. So red cells, white cells, platelets helps prevent severe neutropenia. Helps also to, we had a ASCO a publication on this with preventing hospitalizations, preventing complications, reducing cost, keeping patients on treatment and preventing dose delays or dose reductions. And so I think it's very meaningful. Our patients, you know, it's not uncommon that my patients will finish four cycles of chemo immunotherapy with hemoglobins of 14, normal neutrophils and normal platelets. That's normal practice for us.
So a question to Luis, a lot of people ask about this issue of consolidative chest radiation therapy in small cell. Any comments, Luis?
Yeah, you know, there are some trials trying to answer that question. The bottom line, I would say, may be worthy for a small proportion of patients, particularly those that are having a very good response and still having some remaining spot of disease. And those are maybe 10%, 15% of the patients. And those are, you know, the typical cases we use consolidation radiation here.
And then, you know, everybody, whenever you hear IOs, Misty, people always ask about anti-CTLA-4, ipi-nivo, durva-tremi. Some people bring this up in people who progress on a typical PD-1 agent. Any comments about what we know about anti-CTLA-4, Misty?
Yeah, I think, you know, what we know about small cell is that although it has high TMB, potentially due to chronic exposures with nicotine, you know, we have down regulation of MHC class 1, we have low CD8 T cell infiltration, so really not a hostile immune environment. And so there's potential role of adding a CTLA-4, and this has been shown, Charlie Rudin has shown this in his work with Carolyn Dive, that there might be a potential role. I think in the era of chemo IO first line, I'm not sure what to think of it now, especially with tarlatamab and lurbinectedin there.
So in a second, I'm going to also ask you, I didn't tell you I was going to bring this up, Misty, but I know you had a paper that looked at comparing community-based practice to academic practice, I think, in your area. I want to ask you about that. But first, Luisa, tons of questions about autoimmune issues with IOs. One very common question was rechallenge. You hear this in, you know, a lot of different diseases and a lot of different issues. But how do you approach the issue of a patient develops autoimmune complications, whether it's pneumonitis, diabetes, adrenal insufficiency, cardiomyopathy, any of these problems? That problem resolves. The patient maybe has already had a response. Would you rechallenge and under what circumstances, Luis?
Okay, so, you know, I'm maybe more liberal today as compared to 5 years ago. So I tend to rechallenge more, but still taking into account what is the complication and what severity of the complication. For example, if my patient is having a colitis or a pneumonitis, grade 3, and is responding very well to steroids in less than a week, is grade 1, I may be prone to rechallenge the patient. On the contrary, my patient is having a cardiomyopathy, I typically do not rechallenge my patient. Maybe if the patient is progressing, I could think there about rechallenging, but not immediately. You know, that is the same true for encephalitis. I don't like to rechallenge that. But, you know, the rest of the cases, I'm a bit more liberal, particularly if the response to steroids is very good, is very quick.
And to me, this is another issue where, you know, if your goal is cure, you're kind of thinking differently than it's palliation or, hey, the PFS, you know, hazard rate wasn't that great. But Louise pointed out, even though the PFS in general is not that great, you do see this tail. Misty, you had a thought?
You know, I think really to this next point, I was going to say, you know, if the new, you know, immune mediated adverse events occur, it may not necessarily be a bad thing for patients as long as they're stabilized and doing well clinically. You know, we know that for non-small cells, so many of these patients do actually better off of therapy because their immune system is just in so much overdrive against the cancer.
Yeah, and you know, that's a, you know, I saw that in one of the papers you wrote that it looks like the data is starting to suggest that they might have a higher response rate. This other question, Luis, I thought was really interesting. If you have autoimmune toxicities with IOs, are you more likely to have CRS or ICANS with tarlatamab? Do we know anything about that, Luis?
So we know that those patients that are having a good response, I mean, an immune side effect, they tend to do better on immunotherapy. I don't think today this is true for CRS on ICANS on tarlatamab. It's not a predictor for outcome. So that is an important part for it. Secondly, it's not easy to predict which patients are going to have a CRS. At the beginning, we thought that, you know, high tumor burden could be related to that. And patients with poor PS, LDH, and so on. You know, today the data are not so convincing on that way, and it's not easy. And you're getting CRS in about 50% of the patients. But we know now that the CRS rate is the same during the first cycle as compared to the after a couple of cycles of chemo. So I'm not sure that we are very good at predicting that.
So here's another question that kind of does change in my mind a little bit if you're talking about the possibility of cure. Misty, how do you approach patients with prior transplant, particularly renal transplant? This has, you know, been a general question out there for IOs in general. I'm not sure people thought about it too much in terms of small cell. But again, if your goal is cure, it's a different story. So any, how do you, have you faced that situation, Misty? Also, I always brag that our chat room is the best chat room in the business. So we have a question in the chat room that none of the 50 oncologists, of the hundreds of questions from Hassan, what about PARP inhibitors in small cell? I never thought about that one. Yeah, so Misty, yeah. PARP inhibitors, and what about IOs in transplant patients?
Yeah, so, you know, I have encountered a few patients with transplants or also very severe autoimmune diseases that have been on biologics. I think in those cases, you know, it is a shared informed decision making. I've tended to shy away from it, as well as IO and paraneoplastic syndromes like LEMS, Lambert-Eaton, myasthenia syndrome, because the potential risk for harming and impairing quality of life to me seems a little bit too great. But again, the patient has to make that decision and have all the information to make that decision. For PARP inhibitors, I think that, you know, there was a study, S1929, that was a SWOG cooperative group study looking at the role of PARP inhibitors in a selected group with SLFN11 positive versus negative. Slight improvement in progression-free survival. I don't think it was clinically significant, literally less than a month, I would say, benefit. So, you know, I don't think we're there yet. The idea was that potentially that was not the right PARP inhibitor and that a different one should be used. Not sure. It also causes a lot of myelosuppression. So again, after chemotherapy, if your counts are not intact, to add that on as maintenance might be more harm than good.
So maybe we'll have to do a second webinar to deal with all these questions. I'm just going to bring a couple more up. And also, Maria in the chat room wants to know about, we're not going to talk about it now, Maria, but I just want to bring up that she brought up the issue of CNS activity of tarlatamab. We'll get to that later, because there's another thing out there called IDXD in terms of CNS that I really want to ask you all about after ESMO. But Luis, of course, always the issue of PCI comes up in small cell. How are you approaching the issue of PCI currently? Mm-hmm. Interesting question here. Surgery for solitary brain met, any role in small cell? I thought that was very interesting. And then we already talked about radiation, but what about transform non-small cell into, transform non-small into small cell, even prostate cancer, you can see small cell. Does it respond to these same therapies? So let's start out with PCI, Luis.
Okay, so, you know, I'm typically now using very little PCI in extensive stage. You know, there is a Japanese trial that compared to MRI follow-up, and you do an MRI every 3 months, you may, and you treat patient at the time of relapse, you may avoid irradiation. This is particularly relevant today that, as you know, we are having a tail in the curve of survivorship. So we don't like to cure a patient and having a significant cognitive deterioration because of the PCI. So I'm not doing PCI these days, or at least I'm recommending not to do it. I go through pros and cons with my patients, but I do not typically do it. You know, I only do surgery on those patients with a small cell if there is a clear, urgent need, like the patient is going into hydrocephalia or things like that. If not, you know, I'm typically going to chemotherapy and radiation irradiation therapy if needed. I don't think if the patient is having some metastasis, very likely is having some other micrometastatic disease in the brain. So I don't typically do that today.
And then, Misty, what about transformed into small cell? Do they respond to these therapies?
Yeah, so we actually have an IIT looking at this. This is a patient population that has been really kind of left out alone and not concluded in many trials. And so, you know, historically it's been after a biopsy-proven transformation to show histologic transformation, which is the only way. It can't be a liquid biopsy. And so after a tissue biopsy showing that, usually it's platinum etoposide, really controversial whether you should give immunotherapy. EGFR is low response, you know, potentially 10% gain in small cell, but then continuing the EGFR targeted therapy like osimertinib if there's no on target or other resistance mechanisms to the EGFR TKI. After that, really, it's been we all kind of threw our hands up in the air and said, what do we do? These are usually young women who have their whole lives ahead of them. What can we do next? And so, you know, I think that we've seen the real world data with tarlatamab at 14 cases just presented earlier this month. Only one case with a response that was presented out of the Onward Small Cell Consortium led by Dr. Sonam Puri. You know, I think that that made us pause as to maybe this DLL3 bites. Well, we know there's DLL3 93% positive at transformation. There's a study on that, that it maybe it's not biologically or relevant, or potentially the approach is just not the right one. So we are looking at lurbinectedin and osimertinib for transformed under a study as an IIT with Dr. Triparna Sen as my collaborator.
You know, I have treated some patients with tarlatamab in the initial trials that they allow. And actually, I got a very good response out of 2 patients. So, you know, it's a small N, I would say. And Dr. Ahn in Korea is now doing a dedicated phase 2 trial. So we'll see. What is true is that I think those patients with transformed small cell tend to respond worse also to platinum etoposide. They do respond, but maybe a bit lower, and duration of response is lower as well.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about, we've been talking about what's been out there for a while, and now we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about what's happening now, particularly what happened at the ASCO meeting. And of course, just last month, we saw the approval of the combination of atezolizumab and lurbinectin as maintenance therapy in small cell. This is based on the presentation at ASCO and then the immediate publication in Lancet of the IMforte, phase 3 IMforte study. Luis, can you talk about the design of the study and from your point of view, what were the key findings?
Yeah, so, you know, the reason to do this study was because patients respond very well to chemoimmunotherapy, but typically the duration of the response is quite short. When you start the maintenance treatment with atezolizumab or durvalumab, at the time of the first CT scan, half of the patient had a relapse. That means 2 months, half of the patient had a relapse. So in our lab, we have seen that the combination of lurbe plus atezo maybe additive or synergistic, and actually was able to elicit in immunocompetent models some T-cell memory. So we have done a phase one trial, a phase two, with clear activity in the relapse setting, and then we took the combination to the maintenance setting. So patients that respond to first line chemoimmunotherapy for four courses or had a stable disease, no disease progression, were randomized for atezo versus atezo plus lurve and standard doses. Every patient received G-CSF primarily, and as you see here, clear improvement in PFS, hazard ratio 0.54, and clear improvement in overall survival, hazard ratio 0.73. So, you know, that was, of course, at the cost of some increase in toxicity. The increase in toxicity was mainly grade 1 and grade 2, nausea, vomiting, asthenia, and so on. Importantly, there was no increase in febrile neutropenia, less than 2%. There was no increase in sepsis or severe infections. And the discontinuation rate was very low, 6% as compared to 3% in the atezo arm. So altogether, you know, I think it's a reasonable option to talk to patients. I mean, you're improving survival, you're prolonging the remission, and that is at the cost of some toxicity, for sure. But mainly grade 1 or 2, and that happened mainly in the initial three courses of lurve plus atezo. So I think it's a good opportunity to discuss with patients. I understand a patient that had a lot of toxicity, don't like to make it. If the patient had a brain metastasis, we do not have strong evidence. Remember that in this trial, we didn't include patients with brain metastasis. But altogether, I think it's a good opportunity for patients.
So, Misty, I'm curious about how what you've seen in terms of tolerability of this combination and the maintenance therapy. It's one thing to look at a trial, but I'm curious, you know, is it similar to what you see when you see second-line lurbinectin? Maybe they're kind of in better condition. Maybe, I don't know how they tolerate it. So I'm curious what you have observed, but also Luis was talking about the potential for Lurbi to potentiate PD-1. And I see you have a paper in Cell Reports Medicine, which most of us don't read, but interestingly, lurbinectin sensitizes PD-1 blockade therapy by activating the STING IFN signaling pathway. Can you comment on that and then your experience with this combination?
Yeah, so that was a lovely collaboration with Dr. Chaparna Sen, who is now at The Ohio State University as well. And she and her lab and our collaboration found that there is a vulnerability there with the STING interferon pathway with this combination of lurbinectin and immunotherapy. Our laboratory also has an additional biomarker that hopefully will be coming out soon that can maybe be a test that you could say this is the right patient for this regimen, in which we received an ASCO Conquer Cancer Career Development Award for. But I think that, you know, there is clear data, there's clear repetition and reproducibility here of the combination of immunotherapy with lurbinectin in the tumor microenvironment and on the small cell itself with biologic activity. I think that, you know, yes, I am treating patients with this. I've treated a handful so far already. And now with the approval by the FDA here in October of this year, I think that, you know, this is my advocation for trilaciclib. Patients are doing great on this therapy because their hematologic reserve is intact because they were on trilaciclib with the chemoimmunotherapy. They're starting off great, normal neutrophils, normal hemoglobin, normal platelets. You know, remember that G-CSF and remember no brain mets at baseline or history of brain mets because of the mechanism of action of Lurbi that it just can't penetrate the brain.
And Luis, here's a slide from the conclusions of the discussant, Dr. Meter at ASCO, who brought up the issue of subtypes. I'm curious what your thoughts are in terms of, I wasn't even aware there were subtypes of small cell. And then a question that many people in the survey asked, and even in the chat room, I see a bunch of people, potential role of ctDNA.
Okay, so, you know, I mean, the transcriptomic subtypes of small cell lung cancer had been great. They had helped us to understand the biology of this disease. However, today, I mean, they are not ready for prime time in terms of using them in the clinic to guide our treatment. It is not clear that are really predictive for the benefit from the given therapy. There are some ongoing trials personalizing by the subtyping, including, as been asked before, PARP inhibitors, ATR inhibitors, and so on, but the data are not robust yet. In terms of biomarkers, unfortunately, we do not have biomarkers. That is the bottom line so far in small cell lung cancer. And ctDNA is something that makes a lot of sense. In fact, we can use the ctDNA to actually subtype our patients by doing a methylome analysis, which is really is telling us about the transcriptomic subtyping. Other than that, today is not to be used in the clinical practice, honestly.
So I want to get into some of the questions. Many, as soon as the ASCO meeting happened, people started asking me about this study and what to do about it. So I want to show you some of the questions we got. But just getting back to what you were talking about, Misty, in terms of the possibility or, you know, maybe likelihood that LURB is actually enhancing PD-1 activity. I'm curious what your thoughts are about other potential enhancements of PD-1. We did a program with your colleague, Dr. Haymock from MD Anderson. He told me about this wild paper they presented, I think it was at AACR, that showed people who had COVID vaccines had better responses to PD-1 agents. Also, there's been things out there about antibiotics in response to PD-1. Misty, any comments?
Yeah, I think we just don't have enough data in small cell. I was actually asked this question this week by a new patient in clinic. You know, is there a role for the COVID vaccine or mRNA-based vaccines for this? I think we just need the randomized data to actually know if there's a signal or if there's other confounders or other, you know, elements there. Maybe it's a patient who's more likely to get preventative care or get additional, you know, health services. So, you know, it's hard to know. That might be the patient that follows up more carefully or reports symptoms earlier, and so those might be patients that are going to do better from that reporting. It's hard to know. I think that, you know, it'd be nice to see a randomized study to know the impact of a lot of these support systems, and really, you know, we know even early palliative care patients do better with lung cancer. So, you know, is it just that patients with small cell need more support to live happier, healthier lives? I think it's hard to know.
Incidentally, just to follow up when I was bringing up before, this study that you did on tertiary care around you versus community care, you mentioned palliative care. I noticed that in the academic center, there was more palliative care, there was more second-line therapy, and of course, there were more trials. Anything you want to say, though, about what you saw there comparing community practice to academic practice?
Yeah, I think, you know, it speaks volumes that we need more trial slots. There needs to be more opportunities for, you know, tomorrow's advancements today with research through trials. And, you know, that there needs to be, unfortunately, you know, sharing of the wealth. And I know that these trials are expensive and they can't have sites everywhere. But, you know, we know that patients, you know, live longer, have access when they have access to additional therapies versus if we're not pursuing additional therapies because they don't want to pursue standard of care or best supportive care, which is reasonable. So I think that, you know, it's prudent for us to always be looking for clinical trials and calling on a colleague if we have opportunities to share a mutual patient at a center that's not ours. You know, I very commonly refer patients to the NIH, to Dr. Nish Thomas for clinical trials when it's outside the scope of a patient's care plan that I, you know, may not have anything else in my toolkit to provide them. And so I think it's knowing when to call on a colleague or seek out a trial. But, you know, I think the integration of palliative care was one of the things that we saw that patients, you know, do well with the integrated palliative care in the clinic environment. So as that can be done, that's, you know, ideal.
I remember when Dr. Temmel from MGH, her trial first came out on palliative care in lung cancer patients, Dr. Tom Lynch said, if this were a drug, we'd be using it. I'm not sure whether we are as well as we could. But anyhow, so Luis, here's a panoply of questions, hundreds of questions about this issue. I'll let you pick out whichever one. So starting out with, maybe instead of saying is maintenance lurbinectedive now standard, I would say is presenting the possibility or option of lurbinectedive maintenance considered standard. Also questions about adjusting doses, dosing frequency for toxicity. Who, from your point of view, is an optimal candidate, fit versus comorbid, good performance status, younger versus older, low tumor burden, high. How long should the maintenance be? Should it be indefinite or stopped? And could you stop one of the agents, like lurbinectedive, for example, or IO, and continue the other? So your choice, what you want to talk about out of there.
Okay, so, I mean, for me, lurbinectedine plus atezolizumab is the standard of care in terms of maintenance. Always that the patient is an adequate candidate and like to take it. There are a number of things here important. The main reason for me to consider standard is because less than 50% of the patients are candidates for second line. Once the patient is relapsing, the probability of being treated is not very high. Patients are deteriorating very high. So the best palliation in small cell lung cancer is the best treatment, is treating well the cancer, honestly. Secondly, as you have mentioned before, today we have an extra bonus as compared to 10 years ago. There is a small but a clear 10 or 12% of the patients that are long-term survivors. So I really like to maximize the probabilities of benefiting of my patients. So that is the main reason I'm doing so. So, of course, a good candidate is a patient which is on a reasonable health. This regime is reasonably well tolerated. So, you know, you can have some comorbidity if it's not too much. PS0, 1.5 is fine to me. The patients with brain metastasis may be not the best candidates. As is being mentioned, you know, this is a macromolecule, is not penetrating very well in CNS. And we have seen in some trials in the past with lurbinectedin that brain metastasis could happen more often, you know. So that wouldn't be my first choice. At least we haven't got data, robust data, to recommend that. In terms of biomarkers, we do not have biomarkers. If I'm using that, I typically use it until the patient is progressing or is having a toxicity that is deteriorating quality of life. And I typically do not stop any agent. If my patient is having too much myelotoxicity or toxicity for chemo, I may drop lurbinectedin. That was quite infrequent in the trial. And I only stop immunotherapy if the patient is progressing or is having a severe autoimmune type of adverse event.
So, Misty, I'm going to let you take a crack at some of these other questions, but also there's a question in the chat room from Maria. Do you require a port for LURB-B? She had a patient who had an extravasation. Do you require a port?
So I let it be a patient selection. If patients, have poor venous access or have had repetitive trauma from chronic venipuncture, then, you know, we'll get a portacath. But it's not necessarily required. You can do peripheral or central. And I think, you know, just to add one thing to Dr. Pazarez's point, you know, I think that we also saw the patterns of progression from lurbinectedin, from lurbinectedin from the IMforte follow-up data at ESMO. And one really important thing is that the atezolizumab only arm had very high levels of hepatic, so liver metastases, which I think is really important. That's an area that can be very prohibitive for other lines of therapy. And the addition of lurbi seemed to help prevent that, although we saw higher numbers of brain metastases in that arm. So I think it's really important to think about, especially if you may have patients who have liver metastases at diagnosis, just to think about with that combination on IMforte. For the questions here, you know, I have used either anti-PD-L1 agent, both durvalumab and atezolizumab, just because that was what the patient was on before they switched to maintenance therapy. So I have had that. I haven't had any uptick in adverse events, you know, but that is in my clinical practice. And so I have continued them on the durvalumab and added the lurbinectedin plus G-CSF here. And then I think on the toxicities, and again, what I would expect from the trial, you know, the hematologic, watching the neutrophils, watching the bilirubin, and then the fatigue. I think with cancer-related fatigue, compounding it is very meaningful. But again, I have not seen this in any severe grade, you know, outside of grade one in my practice.
So maybe we'll try to get back to this or some questions coming into the chat room, mm-hmm. but I want to try to also talk about tarlatamab and also mention that Louise did a fabulous presentation at ASCO education session on tarlatamab, so check that out. We're not going to go through all the detail on the trials or there, but particularly, of course, the paper that was presented at ASCO and then published in the New England Journal of Second Line Therapy. Louise, can you summarize a little bit about Delphi 304 and how you see it affecting second-line therapy in small cell?
Okay, so as Maria told us at the beginning of this session, small cell lung cancer had a clear downregulation of class 1 molecules. For that reason, antigen presentation is not happening as well as should be. So there is a lack of antigen presentation very often. So that means there is no initial priming of the immune system. So what is doing the tarlatamab is on is a bispecific that on the one hand is binding to the small cell lung cancer cell on the DLL3 antigen in the surface of the cell, and on the other hand, it engaging the T cell, and is inducing a synapsis without canonical antigen presentation. As you have mentioned, the drug is effective, and in this phase 3 trial, in pure second-line setting, has shown that it's more effective as compared to a standard of care chemo, topotecan, lurbinectedin, or amrubicin. Is improving survival, hazard ratio 0.6, decreased 40% the rate of death all along. It's also improving PFS, and I think that is pretty significant, and is improving as well quality of life, at least symptom control. In terms of adverse events, the drug is reasonably well tolerated. It's inducing CRS in 50% of the patients, typically low grade, and in the first cycle. Some patients are having ICANS, again, typically low grade, first or second cycle, and some dysgeusia and some loss of appetite. This is today, you have a protocol in place and people well trained is actually very well tolerated. The only thing is you have to learn how to handle that. If you have been doing so, you actually can do that in the outpatient setting. You don't need to admit patients if the patient is in good shape, is living nearby the hospital. That could be done in the outpatient after a period of observation of 8 hours or so. This is how do we do it in most of the cases today. We only admit elderly patients, patients that are far away from the hospital, but most of the patients are actually treated outpatient.
And again, the discussion there from Dr. Meader, you know, talked about kind of a new sequencing concept in small cell extensive stage disease, chemoimmunotherapy plus or minus lurbinectinib, and in a lot of patients, I think it's going to be lurbinectinib, tarlatamab, and then third line after that. And then, Misty, of course, this leads to the question of what happens if you don't give tarlatamab in maintenance. Do you still give a second-line tarlatamab? So if you don't use lurbinectin in maintenance, do you still go to tarlatamab second-line, and would you go to lurbinectin third-line, for example?
Yeah, so I think that really we're seeing the landscape of small cell shifting real time before our eyes. And so I think that, you know, as we see lurbinectedin move from the relapse setting potentially to maintenance, we're seeing the shifting of the second line to tarlatamab with Delphi-304. I think that, you know, if you're not using it in the maintenance setting with lurbinectedin there, then it would be, you know, again, a shared informed decision-making. Does a patient have brain mets? What is the amount of disease burden right here to decide? And I usually have equipoise with my patients, but I do talk about the Delphi 304 data with them showing that improvement. Again, if you look at the fine details there, lurbinectedin was really underpowered to in that Delphi 304 phase 3 study, just a small representation there, but really outpowering topotecan and then amrubicin, which is in Japan. So I think that we're seeing that shift. I think that also we just saw the Delphi 303 study, which is tarlatamab in the maintenance setting with either anti-PD-L1 therapy, atezo, or durva. Median overall survival is 25 months, but the response rate while on the tarlatamab was only about 24%. So it's not a home run for everybody, but if it is, you know, I think we're seeing the phase 3 data, Delphi 305 should report out hopefully in the next year or so. But then I think we may see a shifting again of the maintenance therapy for the landscape here.
Yeah. So, Luis, so any thoughts about there's one of the docs submitted a case of 71-year-old man, extensive stage disease, has a PR to carbo, etoposide, atezo, then goes on maintenance, atezo, LURB, progresses in 6 months. Wants to know platinum rechallenge versus tarlatamab. I want to know, like, do you ever do platinum rechallenge second line, or do you pretty much always go to tarlatamab?
You know, if my patient is candidate for tarlatamab and I have access to it, tarlatamab is the best second line. I mean, you know, in the initial phase 1 trial, now that is matured in terms of follow-up, response rate was only 24%. There were a lot of patients, third line, fourth line, but median survival was exceeding 18 months. And this is, you know, what is going to happen likely in the 304 trial. When the trial matures, median survival is actually increased. So, and that means a number of things. The first one, this is changing the natural history of small cell lung cancer. That means if you're increasing survival to 18 months in the third line setting, I suppose in the maintenance setting is going to have even higher impact. So I didn't see the data, but my expectation would be that the maintenance phase 3 trial is going to be really positive and is going to change the way we treat patients once again. The second thing is that, you know, PFS with tarlatamab is pretty low. It's 4 to 5 months. So you only having 4 to 5 months PFS, but you're living 18 months, you're going to have 14 months that you are candidates for further therapies. So I think into the future, we are going to treat a lot of patients, third line, fourth line, and so on, with small cell lung cancer, something that we didn't do in the past. And for that reason, we really need some new drugs that are effective in this setting.
So I want to try to squeeze in one more thing. We have so much to talk about here today, just showing you how much there is in a small cell to talk about. But MISTI, ADCs in small cell, in particular, I like to call it IDXD because it's hard for me to pronounce infinatumab. I guess I can do that. But what I wanted to ask about because this is from ESMO, that I was kind of not exactly surprised about. It kind of reminded me of what we see with TDXD in breast cancer, which is we had a lot of questions that you heard already about CNS activity of chemoimmunotherapy, CNS activity of lurbinectinib and of tarlatamab, none of which I've seen very much activity. But the data at ESMO in brain mets look pretty impressive. It kind of reminds me in breast cancer. You see really good responses to TDXD in the brain. People think, oh, it's an ADC. It's not going to get into the brain. Any thoughts about IDXD? People asked, is it going to be approved? When is it going to be approved? What situation you use it? And what do you think about the brain met data?
Yeah, I think this is a really novel field for small cell lung cancer, antibody drug conjugates. Really think it is a Trojan horse, recognizing targets on the small cell with the chemotherapy, you know, missile payloads there, delivering it there. So again, we're thinking of hematologic toxicities, potentially, you know, neuropathies and such, low risk of ILD. But I think with these, you know, we're seeing B7H3, which is the target of IDXD, which may be overexpressed in poor prognostic cases of small cell. We saw Pedro Rocha present the data from ESMO with brain mets, high concordance and systemically to intracranially. A lot of these patients having complete responses on their brain mets at the 12 mg per kg dose, higher response rate systemically as well in the dose escalation from the IDA-Lung02 study, Lung01 study, and then now with the phase 3 study ongoing. Remember, both sacituzumab govitecan against TROP2 and IDXD against B7H3 both have breakthrough designations from the FDA. So it shows that they're very efficacious agents. I'm hoping that we'll start seeing these regulatory approvals coming out soon. We've seen a lot of regulatory accelerated approvals with phase 2 data with both lurbinectedin and tarlatamab. So hopefully we'll start to see this breakthrough with ADCs and small cell here shortly.
So one final question, getting back to Luis. Luis, can you briefly summarize your vision about how extensive stage small cell is going to be treated in 2 to 3 years?
Well, I think the main change as compared to today is that T-cell engagers, tarlatamab, maybe other of the class, are going to be part of the first-line treatment. Could be as maintenance or also part of the induction treatment. The second thing that may happen is that PD-L1 inhibitor may be in the future replaced by a bispecific, a PD-1 or PD-L1 by VEGF. And the third thing is that platinum etoposide could be replaced or not by an ADC with a topo-1 payload. For sure, the T-cell engager is going to happen. The other two, it may happen, but I wouldn't bet all my money on it.
Anything you want to add to that, Misty?
Yeah, of course. So I think with lung cancer screening, obviously we're seeing a shift in earlier diagnoses. And I think we're seeing that also with small cell. We see that in our own data and also a lot of real world data that patients with are having more limited stage, which obviously they are going to get chemo, rads, and immunotherapy. More patients are being cured that way. So I think if we're shifting it earlier, shifting these effective strategies with BiTEs, ADCs, Lurbi earlier, we're going to see this really transformational shift in small cell, more patients being cured, and I think it's going to we're going to see it just in the next few years.
So Misty and Luis, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Misty. Luis, thank you so much.
Thank you.